thank you all very much for joining us today for this very special webinar. We're happy to have Dan Bresnitz and Jane Gingrich with us. The November 2024 issue of the Healthcare Management Forum is going to be focused on innovation. And many of you know Dan Bresnitz was the author of Innovation in Real Places, published 2 years ago. And it won several public policy awards, advancing thinking about the importance of innovation in the Canadian economy. Jane is a co-director with Dan in the program that they have undertaken. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome each of them. So to open up the discussion, can I ask Dan, what does CIFAR think it needs to have an innovation prosperity as part of its goals? So innovation, equity, and prosperity are central to your thesis in your book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first, thank you so much, Don, for having me here and having me and Jane talking. As you mentioned, we are both a co-director of CIFAR, Canadian Institute for Advanced Research Program on Innovation, Equity, and the Future of Prosperity, through which we have organized many of the papers in this special issue. As I think you know, CIFAR, by its very name, is really interested not only in fundamental questions, but in the ability to bring minds together from all over the world in Canada. So Jane, for example, now teaches in Oxford, and we have a network of global scholars from all over the world looking at really important questions with the hope of actually creating a new subfield. In the case of our group, we came because we are really concerned about the way we are doing innovation around the world and how we can do it in a way that leads to a more equitable, not just equal, but more equitable, both outcomes, but also the whole process, which leads to what we all hope. And this is especially true in the case of health in Canada, because I think many of us are worried it's going in the wrong direction, but leads to prosperity. So Jane, if you want to add a few words of how we started even thinking about healthcare.
So I just want to take a little bit of a step back. So Danny's introduced the kind of basic structure of our program, which is really looking at the fundamental question of how we combine these three things that we want together: innovation, equity, and prosperity. But to put that in a little bit of context of what CIFAR is actually doing, what they're actually funding when they're bringing us together, is the CIFAR model goes back more than 40 years in terms of funding teams that collaborate over an extended period of time working on a common set of questions. And the core idea of these teams is that they're interdisciplinary, so that they're bringing together people that wouldn't normally talk. Or if they do talk, it's for a short amount of time. And the CIFAR model says, let's figure out a way to bring together people that are thinking about problems from different angles and have repeated discussions among them. So within our group, what we've been doing for the last 5 years, or actually a little bit more than that, is bringing together people from very different kinds of backgrounds. So we have engineers in the groups, so including from the healthcare field, robotics engineers. We have economists, political scientists, sociologists, and so on. And we've been having these collaborative discussions about how do we think about making innovation more inclusive. And one of the areas that really came up through these discussions is that, you know, a lot of time when we're talking about innovation, it's about new technology like generative AI, ChatGPT, robots, and so on in the workplace. But in fact, there's a huge amount of innovation that's happening in care, both in terms of the kinds of tools used in the healthcare process, but also in the way people are training, the roles that different kinds of workers have. And some of these can really produce more equity. They can allow people in remote locations to access services that they wouldn't have access to before. And others can really reduce equity. So they can make conditions worse for workers and maybe also for patients in the care system. So this was a really ripe area for us to have a kind of integrative discussion of sort of, okay, we care a lot about innovation in general. We care a lot about the quality of healthcare services. Let's try and unpack these questions about innovation and equity within healthcare and use this multidisciplinary lens to do so. And the special issue is really an output of those discussions.
Well, Dan and Jane, that is fabulous. When I think of the efforts that Canadian healthcare leaders are putting to understanding the importance of interdisciplinarity to deal with quality improvement, access to services. This fits in absolutely beautifully. Can you talk a little bit of what CIFAR is doing to stimulate innovation generally, as well as in healthcare specifically?
So let me give you a few examples. So CIFAR and where it is unique, if you want to think about it, it's the only institution we have in Canada, and I would argue one of very few around the world, that actually take what we call scholarship and research seriously and says, okay, we want you to do research that would lead to innovation in ways that are not already done. So we will allow you to meet around a problem. One of the most famous one in CIFAR history was artificial intelligence, for example, which was not called that. Early education, so impacts of CIFAR's program was to, in Canada, was the fact that now we have kindergarten education as part of a public system. I don't know how many people knows about it, but it all originated from original research that brought people that did not talk to one another from disciplines that otherwise wouldn't have care to think about early brain development and learning. And our group is interested in one of the most important topics of our time, which is innovation and its impact on economic growth, its impact on our quality of life. For example, what we are doing now is a wonderful thing, right? We all sit in our homes with a camera, we are talking, we have a wonderful product. It also means that now in our home, we are working all the time. It also means that now in our home, there's cameras and microphones that constantly listen to us. How as a society we deal with us, how we make sure that that innovation translates into equitable society, into a more prosperous society, is what we aim to do. And to do that, what CIFAR allow us to do, which is unique, is bring people from law, from history, from philosophy, from every social science that you can think of, any engineers that you want to do, scientists. And to our meeting, we bring the world expert on that specific meeting. And we do it again and again and again until those very different viewpoints that comes to real innovation in a place that otherwise they would have never met. I mean, we might have said hi to each other as we go to teach our very separate subjects.
Excellent. Jane, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, so I think in the innovation space, there's a number of challenges. And one of them is just creating the institutions and incentives for people to engage in kind of risky, longer run projects. And I think one of CIFAR's core goals is to actually create the space for scholars to come together over the long run and do innovative activities together. And that's really fundamental to the model that they have for funding groups coming together. But if we just sat around and talked to each other all the time, it could be very interesting and fun, but it wouldn't have these positive spillovers into parts of, say, the Canadian research space or the real economy and people's lives. And so another tranche of what CIFAR does is they try to kind of mobilize that knowledge. And so it's this really nice mix of giving scholars the space to do original research that they wouldn't have done otherwise, of the type that Danny mentioned in his response, but then also giving the support once that knowledge has matured to connecting it to policymakers or people in the private sector as well that are working in these areas. And that's the example he gave of one of the other groups in the entire CIFAR space, which has done a lot of work on child and brain development, that the institution was also able, once that research matured, to really match people up. So I think CIFAR's strategy for promoting innovation in Canada is one that's kind of this Goldilocks strategy. Give groups long enough to develop original, novel, innovative ideas, but also really support them, but not give them so long that it's all just happening in an ivory tower. Also support them to go out to the public in a variety of ways and communicate that knowledge. And so that's the broad strategy. Our group is in this phase where we've been meeting for 5+ years. We're beginning to really develop some of this interdisciplinary knowledge. And now we're thinking about how to mobilize that in a way that really supports policymakers in Canada and beyond in terms of thinking about how you really create a strategy for innovation that takes questions of equity very seriously.
Well, healthcare leaders that have picked up innovation in real places and read it will have noticed the importance that you give to identifying evidence-based medicine and policy movement, which actually started here at McMaster University in Canada. That movement has been global, and there's been a commitment on healthcare leaders, policymakers to, in fact, utilize best evidence to inform questions. So all of the articles that were facilitated through the involvement, Dan and you, Jane, identify really areas in which there's good evidence being pulled together to identify ways in which to innovate healthcare. What are some of the examples that you'd like to highlight out of that issue?
One, there's a few, I think, extremely timely things for Canada, the world in general, but let's focus on Canada. One of the first one is after COVID is the need to bring back animal health and human health and tie them together, which is not only smart from the point of view of knowing where you're going to be attacked and what you should do about it, but also in a huge country such as Canada, where we are lacking health resources and where we have more animals than people, not allowing vets and doctors to work together, be trained together, know how to deal with things together is a mistake we cannot repeat. And even more interestingly, it was something we were the leaders of, but like so many things, we no longer are the leaders of. So let's bring back that innovation to Canada. That's one example. A second example, which I think is extremely important for Canada at the moment, is the impact. And I have to say many times a negative impact of the way in which we are playing with privatization in Canada and bringing big finance into health. And there's several papers on that. There's the issue of how you make your hospital and not just your university hospital into hotbeds of invention, discovery, and then innovation, both in artificial intelligence, but also in just how you treat clients, customers, patients, whichever one you want to call them. And by the way you call them also say how you're going to treat them. And then there is questions of how you put technology, for example, robotics, to deal with chronic problems, age, and various sicknesses. And the way that you do that and the way in which you even think about how you do it in the end have to be reflected in the way you do the research and develop the solution itself. And also have to take into account, which we have not done well in Canada, not just the supposed potential health outcomes, not just how the technology is cool, but who are the people that actually are going to use it? How they're being paid? Why should they use it? Are they being trained to use it? Are there negative impacts to their life of using it, which means that they will just not use it? And apart from the lab, does it actually do the job that we want to do? And I think all of those are critical questions that health leaders in Canada need to at least be aware of.
Thank you for that, Dan. So, Jane, you have one of the articles in the special issue, November of this year. Tell us a little bit about the research that you did and what findings, and of course, the impact of COVID-19 globally and in Canada, fairly significant. What lessons come out of your work?
So just take a step back for a moment. I think one of the things that came up in Danny's answers to the previous question is the innovation in healthcare has been a buzzword for some time, but in the kind of wake of COVID-19, in which there's a real questioning of a lot of domestic innovative capacities in the healthcare, it's come back in a new way. And so we saw a number of supply chain disruptions that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we also saw a number of systemic vulnerabilities in many countries. So a lack of domestic manufacturers of many key goods, including vaccines, that raise questions about how do we think about what we want from our own domestic health innovation ecosystem. So this is the background to the article that we wrote. Now, as Danny said in the introduction, I am Canadian, but I now live in the UK. So in the midst of the pandemic in the UK, as probably listeners will be well aware, there was a substantial effort on domestic vaccine manufacturing, including at my university, the University of Oxford, which ended up having a critical role in developing one of the competing vaccines used in the wake of the COVID pandemic, which was then developed by the AstraZeneca pharmaceutical company. So in this moment in which we saw British government supporting innovation in vaccines and pushing heavily on the research behind that around vaccine development, there was also concern in parallel about public health and usage of vaccines. And so we know that in some countries, there are large gaps among people in terms of the propensity to use vaccines or to become vaccinated. And that was certainly also a concern in the UK. Although rates of vaccination were generally much higher than in, say, the US on average, there was still 10 to 13% of the population that was vaccine hesitant, that was expressing real concerns about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So in this moment, these two currents came together. The emphasis on domestic manufacturing and development of vaccines and the public health concerns to create a kind of a strategy that looked to combine emphasis on British manufacturing of vaccines with the public health strategy. So the government at one point was even considering putting Union Jack flags on vaccines, promoting British homegrown vaccinations as a way to kind of encourage people to take up these. And this wasn't a totally nonsensical idea, in part because the kinds of people that are vaccine hesitant are also concerned about facets of government, had expressed concern about trust in government, and were often much more likely to have actually voted to leave the European Union in the 2016 Brexit referendum as part of their sort of general concern about international institutions and so on. So these are voters that both express low levels of trust in government, but high levels of economic nationalism. So the idea was in part like, okay, if we prime this economic nationalism, maybe we can have some really positive public health benefits to that. So in the midst of this moment, my colleagues and I conducted a two-way panel study using a nationally representative sample of British respondents. And so we interviewed them via survey before the mass rollout of the vaccine and then a month and a half after it was approved in December of 2020. And it looked at both changes and overall levels of support for vaccination among different groups of respondents. And in the second wave of our panel study, what we did was we embedded an experiment within the survey where we primed different attention to nationalist frames. And so we had one where we emphasized the speed and quickness of the British regulatory process. So sort of trying to see if people sort of pride in how quickly vaccines came to the public in Britain might encourage them to take more vaccines. And then secondly, the origin of the AstraZeneca vaccine and it's linked to British universities. And essentially what we found, the takeaway, is it didn't work. So that all of this nationalist priming had no effect on our respondents in terms of their propensity to use vaccines or report that they were likely to use vaccines in the future, despite actually high levels of nationalism amongst the vaccine hesitant respondents. And so I think the conclusion of this, and it's just one study, and there have been other studies that have shown that lower levels of vaccine nationalism matter. So people are much more trusting of vaccines in general made. Western respondents are much more trusting of vaccines made in Western countries like the US or UK than the Sinovac, the vaccines from Russia or China. But that there doesn't seem to be anything particular about priming that it's your national origin that really matters in terms of shaping relative vaccine hesitancy. And what we think is important for Canadian policymakers out of this is that there has been this emphasis on sort of building domestic vaccine manufacturing capacity in Canada, including in Ontario, where there's been a sort of Ontario-made vaccines type of rhetoric. And we think this could be important for all sorts of reasons for having a good supply chain in Canada. But assuming that this will have sort of spillovers on the public health side needs more scrutiny. And certainly we didn't find a lot of evidence of that. So I think there's some lessons for thinking about how you think about nationalist messaging as it relates to public health strategy.
Wow. Well, that's so important and so timely for us to be thinking about that. Because when one is in the midst of a crisis and asking the questions, anecdotal thoughts and evidence ought not to be what motivates our policy solution. It ought to be well-informed, thoughtful. And I thank you for pulling together the work that actually provides some definitive thoughts on how effective or actually harmful something like that might be. Now, let's take an opportunity just to reflect on what the future opportunities are from CIFAR's role in advancing innovation, equity, and prosperity. Dan and Jane, can you talk about some opportunities that you see in the future playing out that we can see facilitated, hopefully with the support of healthcare leaders being involved as part of that interdisciplinary dialogue that you speak of?
Let me start with the, let's call it the most micro level, to going up. There are a lot of things, and most of the innovation, and that really important innovation, happens when the rubber hits the road. We talked about McMaster and evidence-based and the insight that you actually have to work with the population and actually work in the field and figure out what works, what not. If you remember, when you read about that philosophy, also on the way McMaster is still teaching, you give a lot, not only knowledge, but a lot of responsibility and authority for the line worker, the doctors that actually treat patients in this case, to make decisions and influence what is used and how research is done and how innovation is being employed. This is even more important now. And this is even more important, not just on the doctor level, the medical doctor level. We need to create, especially if you want to cut cost or keep cost, which we have to at the same level, but move care into another level with an expanding population, with age going up as more than ever in human history. We need to also allow nurses, caregivers, anyone who actually run the hospital, not the administration that sit and do the finance, but actually run the hospital, like when food comes where, how do I know which food to give to which of the multiple patients I have? Those are the people who actually knows what happened. They can create a huge amount of innovation in that level. They have ideas. They should be able to run experiments. And before you thrust technology that somebody, let's say my student or Jane's student, who of course knows everybody because they finish and everything and everybody because they finish in a top university, never been and seen how you take care of a chronically ill old person. So that's something we have to do. We have a public system and we should be able not only to do it, but to, I don't want to use the word enforce, but strongly incentivize our hospitals to behave as what they should be, which is part of a community of innovators that try to become better and give good service. The second, a lot of our, as you know, I sit in the University of Toronto, and we have a lot of hospitals, and hospitals are the area in which you do a lot of basic research, and are the area in which you also use the latest technology, for example, artificial intelligence. So again, how do we make hospital the labs for the development of new innovation, completely new to the world, and as well, the places in which you use the latest technology and figure out how to use it effectively. And when I mean effectively, is not making somebody rich, in making somebody more healthy. Which leads me to the other issue is we are playing and experimenting with various forms of privatization. Some because of pent-up demand, because the system just doesn't work. So Cleveland Clinic have at least two full facility just in Toronto with nurses just getting calls and ensuring that Canadian will go to Cleveland to get healthcare. That's one. But we are also importing to our systems financial models, for example, private equity. I'm talking here about the paper by Feldman and others, which we already know because they come from the US, corrupt the system. they're extremely good in making it efficient if what you want is to make profits, but at the expense of both the community and the patient. And the last and not least, within our health system, we have very big companies that we as a society give them a lot of leeway and various legal devices to make money, like patents, as they produce drugs and new medical equipment. It seems, and that's a Lazonik paper, that they have forgotten that they have a social contract, which is why they get all those leeways and all this research money. And it basically seems that they take the equivalent of a public funding in research, and then immediately, instead of investing it, using it to replace their investment, and that investment actually go back in forms of dividend or stock buybacks. So a question is, as we play with privatization, is how are we going to experiment with that? What financial models we give? And if we bring private industry, how do we make sure that the private industry adhere to the social contract and not just adhere to what their analyst in downtown Toronto Bay Street or Wall Street wants them to do?
Extremely timely observation, as we see governments attempting to think about how to shortcut the challenges that they face in the crises. And of course, the most expedient solutions are the ones that seem to be the ones that are described in that article. Jane, do you have anything to add to that?
If we're thinking about these articles as a collectivity, and maybe this just really repeats what Danny has just said, but in a slightly different framing, there's a few just top level points that are worth pulling out and then going into some of the specifics that we've just heard about. So the first is that not all innovations are good, right? So there can be innovations in healthcare that can be harmful for health. And some of the kind of financial innovations that we've seen around private equity, the evidence coming from the United States, but also from Britain, is showing that a lot of these actually don't have positive effects on patients and for taxpayers necessarily either. The second is that good innovations don't always get taken up and diffused. And so this is really a point that the Nejat et al. Paper shows, which is that there are certain kinds of devices, robotics, that can really be extremely helpful within caring environments, particularly around people with long-term needs, and can connect people to services or to support that actually takes a lot of burden off of workers and is good for patients. But oftentimes, the places that care for these patients aren't able to use them. The technology exists, but it's not diffused. And that can happen for really systematic reasons. And so one of the things that they find in that paper is, you know, just things as simple as plugs that allow certain kind of robotic devices to be charged properly are often lacking in particular facilities. So some innovations are bad and shouldn't be diffused. Some innovations are good, are not diffused. And then some innovations just don't happen because we don't have the institutions put together for them to come forward. And this is really the paper that Schrank has looking at veterinary medical interactions, is sort of saying, like, look, there's actually in an era in which climate change is happening, in which a lot of diseases have a zoonotic origin, the intersection of research in veterinary medicine and human health can actually lead to some really positive spillovers in terms of new ideas. And yet we don't have institutions that bring these together. So the good story in which you have a really socially useful innovation that's developed, that's actually diffused through the system, is actually the rare case. And there's all of these things that often prevent positive technology from being developed or diffused, or in fact, that incentivize the use of technologies that are not necessarily good for patients. And then we have the final scenario, in which actually the technology is really not either the cause or the solution to any problems. You just need more funding, better support for workers, and so on. And I think across our papers, what we try to do is sort of parse those scenarios apart and say, what are the institutions that might allow positive, really productive forms of innovation to come together? What are the institutions that might allow those to be diffused? Where are the institutions that might encourage attention to maybe some of these less positive innovations? And where do we actually need to stop talking about technology and innovation and start really just thinking about the underlying support for workers and proper funding in the sector? And I think once we can identify a range of problems in each of those areas and think about the institutions that produce the different kinds of outcomes, we make a lot of progress to sort of saying, where would an innovation strategy in health need to be in this country at this moment in time, which is different than the United States with its very heavily privatized system. It's different than in Britain, which has a publicly funded NHS system, but with very different systems of, say, ownership and control in the hospital sector. And thinking about the kind of general problems of innovation in the specific context of the Canadian healthcare system is, I think, where we make progress towards how we might think about funding particular kinds of innovative activities and the support for diffusing them in different ways.
Thank you. We're getting close towards the end of our time together. So perhaps two last points to be made. The last one will be to ask you to think about the future and what opportunities there might be for us to look at, for example, in 2028, some follow-up special issue of the Healthcare Management Forum that would actually look at some of the outcomes from the experiments that we're hoping that this effort will engender. But before we go to that, I'd just like to mention briefly that in addition to the articles that Dan and Jane worked with invited authors to put together thoughts, we also have other submitted articles. For example, Zelmer did an article of healthcare leaders scaling innovative care models, policies, and technologies to deliver true health or value in health systems. And she talks about the importance of dual approach, addressing immediate health system challenges while fostering a culture of continuous improvement and transformation, which really just reinforces those last points that you were making. And another article that I'll mention is that by Phillips and co-authors, in which they do a comprehensive overview of the evolving role of health leaders in addressing interconnected issues that are threats to planetary health, workforce resiliency, and the erosion of public trust. What are we as healthcare leaders going to do to help address those threats that are out there? So perhaps, Dan, if I could have the two of you just cast your mind to the future. And what do you see in ways in which healthcare leaders can be true partners in advancing the initiatives that are identified so well in this issue?
So a few things. A, and I think the papers mentioned here, for example, the Zehavi and Necht and others, show that our tendency to silo everything, which is even worse in hospital, you know, where you have somebody who knows, I just had a massive motorcycle accident, was hit by a car, and I discovered that we don't even know how to get the various doctors to talk together. And then every treatment is treated just for that symptom without taking into account all the other damages that you have. So what the CIFAR models did, and I think what we've seen in this, is once you put people from disciplines that usually do not work together with a real problem, health, things happen which are much more interesting and are much more applicable and have a chance for happening. For example, using robots in long-term facilities, doing One Health and reconfiguring it how we teach with veterinarian doctors and medical doctors, which would have not happened elsewhere. You look at the good things that might happen when you bring a huge pool of capital like private equity, but you also understand the negative because you have economists and you have business or management scholars that say, hey, stop. We're not about health. We're about profits. Let's figure out whether the profit motive actually help health outcomes or not. And I think the most important thing, if you think about health leaders in all levels, is to allow innovation, which is really where patients need treatment, to happen at all levels and hear the voices around them. And also remember, and I think this is really important within the Canadian health system at the moment, that our goal is not just cost cutting and looking efficiently as if we are a corporation. Our real metric should be the most healthy Canadian for the long period of time under the current resources that we have, not how we cut the current resources that we have to look more efficient in terms of profits.
Anything to add there, Jane?
just that I think health leaders are often really aware of all of the things that sort of silo off and cause problems in terms of not joining up aspects of these things. So I think people on the ground who work in health or who manage healthcare workers or who are responsible for hospitals are really aware that, you know, it would be great if there was more joined up relationships with long-term care. It'd be great if we could have technology that really worked with a kind of patient focus and so on. The challenge is always to figure out how do you do that within the structure that you inhabit at the moment. And I think one of the things that would be great for the future, at least in our group, is to have more dialogue between healthcare leaders and academic researchers to say, like, where can the two inform each other in terms of thinking through these problems and how to create systems that are more innovative and in which innovation is successfully diffused in ways that really improves the health of patients and the job of the workers in the sector. And so I guess I would hope for the future that we could continue these discussions and sort of say, like, okay, how do we create a system where we can learn from healthcare leaders, but also where healthcare leaders can learn something from our interdisciplinary discussions about how to take some of this forward?
We've got a few minutes left, and perhaps I can just give you the creative license to talk about some of the opportunities that if you were to partner with the Canadian College of Health Leaders, which I hope this webinar will stimulate, number one, their awareness and understanding of the role and facilitation of that important bringing together or the joining together of efforts to work on some of those challenges. And so I very much appreciate you setting the stage for those conversations going forward. Any final words before we close?
As someone in the UK, in which I don't know how familiar Canadian health leaders are with the state of the NHS, but the rhetoric at the moment, I think from all levels, from the government, from staff, from managers, et cetera, is kind of doom and gloom. Like it feels overstretched, undercapitalized, underfunded. And even where staffing numbers have gone up, patients are experiencing long delays, high levels of dissatisfaction. So I think it's really hard. And I think aspects of that actually are the same in Canada, though you can correct me if I'm wrong on that. And so on the one hand, we have this doom and gloom, things feel like they're fraying. And on the other hand, there's this sort of rhetoric about what new technology is doing in health and the capacity of technology to improve the quality of many people's lives, to relieve burdens on workers and so on. And it's about how do we create a system in which there's sufficient resources for the people that are operating in a very human and intensive way with patients and workers in the sector to actually feel much more optimistic about where the way things are going and have technology and innovative activities be part of that, but certainly not substitute for the importance of proper funding and also ensuring that the basic infrastructure, physical infrastructure of hospitals and the human resources are there in ways that allow healthcare to be successfully delivered. And I think that that creating a kind of political constituency around that and rebuilding a degree of optimism about the direction of travel is really critical to making the healthcare sector effective in the future. And I think that if technology is sort of opposed or innovation is opposed to these other things, it's going to create distrust and potentially some concern. And so there needs to be a way, I think, to pull broader healthcare reform and funding and proper capitalization of the infrastructure in healthcare together with new innovative techniques. And so that there really is some ability to build on some of these new innovations in a way that's productive for patients and workers and healthcare leaders in the sector.
As you know, in Parliament, we currently have a committee working on privacy of information and data. And of course, you mentioned earlier the emergence of generative artificial intelligence, which is going to have a huge impact on society generally. What are some of your thoughts if you were to give some advice to healthcare leaders about thinking about the future and the integration of some of those tools? What might you suggest?
So it's interesting that you have mentioned that, because one of the subgroups and one of the main areas in which, CIFAR willing, we will continue on to work in the next 5 years of our program are on one side surveillance, on the other side, broadly speaking, the care economy. So let me talk about surveillance, which I think is the most important thing that you have with those new technologies. A, we need to be, when you talk about privacy and privacy information, we need to understand what it is, and that's actually what a group of us in CIFAR are doing. We need to understand what exactly in the way we started to collect data have been transformed and made us actually profit centers. It's in everywhere and every minute of your life, because all of us use mobile devices that basically constantly spy on us. But they spy on us because somebody's making a huge amount of money. And to just say it and just say that this is a privacy actually obscure more than anything. You have to understand why they are doing it, how they're making money, who has property rights over the data, but also the users of data. And then can you do things to, first of all, limit the amount and the number of time you're actually being spied on for the same data? And maybe even disallow some of it. But at least as importantly in health, we should assume that people will somehow get the data. How do we prevent them using it in ways which we don't know? Then there's all those issues about what people call now algorithm discrimination, which many people think that they are new. Since we have historians, we know that they're about 100 years old. It just used to be that there was a human who was a computer and did the algorithm. And it actually was much easier to spot because that human has to write down. So as long as you can read cursive, you can read down how they defend their decisions. And we actually didn't have regulation about what is allowed and what not is allowed. The problem with many of those models is that even the developer of those models have no clue how they reach their decisions. They are being trained on current data of how the world is. We know that the world is racist, discriminatory, chauvinistic. I'm trying to be nice here. And what we do when we train our supposedly artificial intelligence on those data, the artificial intelligence knows how to become a racist, how to use illegal gender statistical relationship in order to make profit. But that might mean that some genders will not be even allowed to get an offer. And then there's a last but not least, especially within the health system, all the workers and the patients are under constant surveillance. How this is used, for what it is used, how we should develop it to have better health outcomes instead of, what should I say, healthier and wealthier lawyers in the United States, is something that we should start talking about, because I have not seen a lot of those debates coming online or even public discussions. We are slightly too stuck in a very, very old framework of privacy.
I really appreciate your focusing in on that, because I am anticipating that healthcare leaders are struggling with that same dichotomous conflict, that they see the opportunity, but on the other hand, the safeguards may not have actually been thought about that carefully.
I'll give you one example, which I think health leaders from a paper, which I think health leaders need to be aware of. When you put an extremely sophisticated robot in long-term facilities, and that robot is, of course, semi-autonomous, it also means that the manager can use that robot to record everything that is happening in the facility, including the behavior of employees and the behavior of patients, who then know that the manager, instead of using the robot to help them, actually use it as a spying device. Think about it for a moment next time you put the technology into your hospital.
Well, with those words of warning, I think we've got the attention of healthcare leaders in Canada and then globally. Well, let me take the opportunity. Jane, thank you so much for joining us, and Dan as well, for doing your important work. And I invite us to come together again in several years when the efforts on the care economy have begun to flesh out efforts that we can explore further and share the results of. So thank you very, very much.